And that still left my outboard pylons. In other words, I had my sidewinder still, but I lit the full afterburner. I half-G'd the airplane. Anybody that flies airplanes know that when you unload a wing on an airplane, you remove the induced drag off that wing, and you really can start moving. Well, the 105, it was in its element now, because that's what it did. It went fast. So I lit the torch. I dove down so I could come up underneath these guys. So I'm sitting there trying to figure my game plan. Now, you got to remember, I'm just a dumb lieutenant. And so I hadn't got as much experience as a lot of these fighter pilots have got. And I really do mean that. I wish I had of, because I could have probably thought through this thing a lot better and been more prepared for it. But I did do the best that I thought I could at the time. So I took it low so they wouldn't see me coming. And I decided, well, I'll roll in on number two and try to swing over on number one. The last thing I saw on my airspeed indicator was 1.3 Mach. For those that don't, Mach 1 is supersonic. That means I'm doing right at about 900 miles an hour. And I didn't realize at the time how slow this 105 and the MiGs were going. I really didn't. I know one thing. They didn't have their burner on, which the MiGs did not, and neither did he, which sort of surprised me, because you would think the MiGs would have to have the burner on to keep up with the 105, period. But, you know, there was a lot going on, and that just hadn't quite sunk into my computer yet. And but they did not have the burner going. So I'm smoking now, and so I'm coming up low, and I'm starting to make my pull toward number two MiG. All of a sudden, now my eyeballs start getting a sense of speed differential here. And I realize that I am absolutely going to, it's smoking like hell, and I'm going to overshoot. And that's the last thing you want to ever do, is overshoot and have an enemy airplane positioned behind you. So what I did is I pulled hard. In fact, my G meter when I got home was 7.5 to 8 G's. I did it smooth, though, so that made it okay. And I pull and I open up with my cannon. Now, the 105 had one of the finest air-to-air weapons in the world, which was a 20 millimeter cannon. It's a Vulcan cannon. It had 6 barrels. It fired 6,000 rounds a minute of 20 millimeter. And we had high explosive shells on board. And so I was actually on his left side, and I thought I saw a flash on his left wing where I hit him. But like I said, I was just smoking. And so I didn't get a chance to really dwell on it very long. And so I'm going up now. I'm almost vertical. There was a broken layer of clouds, and with the clouds, it was sort of like, well, just assume where his knees are, there's a cloud layer. And they were broken. When I went up, I just went up screaming. I popped my boards. I go up over the overcast, and I'm sitting up there, upside down, inverted, saying, "You stupid lieutenant, you had one shot at a MiG, and you blew it." And about that time, remember the cloud layer is right about here. Out from underneath this cloud layer is a MiG-17 with his afterburner going. I'm sorry about that, guys. And I said, oh, my God. And so I'm sitting up there inverted. The MiG's right here. I pull my nose down. I just ease forward a little bit on him, open up. And the first shells went right through the cockpit. Now, that might sound like something that's okay, but there still was respect for the pilots in these other airplanes. I think you've seen plenty of World War II, you know, cases of this. But anyway, the first bullets went right through the cockpit and worked their way down the left side of the airplane. And while I'm actually shooting at this guy, if you ever see my film, you'll see this. 105, totally, he never saw this, because we talked about it when I got back. You know, Karat. He never saw us, but he went right between us. A big ball of fire comes out behind the 105. And I never saw, I didn't really realize what was going on until later. But apparently I had a drop round, because he was below my firing line. And apparently I had a drop round that caught his fuel tank. And at that, with all the MiGs, everybody punched their tanks off, so nobody brought home a compromised tank with a hole in it. When they got back to Yokota everybody had clean airplanes, so we never found out who that was.
David, let me ask you something. Now, you flew 105, almost half of them over Hanoi. Would you do it again?
Not with the current administration, I wouldn't.
That's what I was getting to. Okay. But I want to talk to Dick now, if you'll give it to him, please. Okay, Dick, first of all, would you point out some of the hard points on the airplane, and what did you carry on there?
We carried about anything that you could carry on the A-1. The A-1 actually had two 20-millimeter guns in each wing. This one here only shows one 20-millimeter gun in each wing, but we had two. Each 20-millimeter gun had 200 rounds of ammunition. What we've got on this airplane here is a mini gun that would shoot 6,000 rounds per minute on the stub. This was called the stub where this is mounted. And the next ones outboard, there are Mark 82 500-pound bombs that are have fuse extenders on there. And the reason the fuse extenders are on there are so they'll go off above the ground. They won't crater the ground. It's an anti-personnel weapon. About of that is two canisters of CBUs, which are cluster bomb units. Each one of those tubes has 19 little hand grenade-type weapons in it that is an anti-personnel weapon, or we could put other things in it, but usually they were anti-personnel, like little hand grenades in those things. And as you can see, there's putting two on each wing. And outboard, I don't know what that thing is outboard, but I think that's probably white phosphorus. Yeah, Willie Pete, we call it white phosphorus, and that's used for marking a target. So that was what is carried on this thing, but we could carry also napalm. I think this is a napalm here on that. Okay, that's a propaganda canister, but but it didn't look like a nape. But yeah, the napalm had a rounded nose on it. But we carried a lot of napalm, and I flew mostly nights, and our typical night mission was we'd have four or six canisters of napalm, and then probably four Mark 82 500-pound bombs, and in addition to rockets, and we didn't carry many guns at night, but we did shoot our 20 millimeters at night.
Well, you guys actually flew day missions and night missions, and then you did some forward air control missions, right, or rescue missions, yeah.
Yeah, there was a lot of versatility in the airplane that could do a lot of things. The thing about it is it was a very different war from what Dave experienced. President Johnson stopped the bombing of North Vietnam on November 1st of 1968. My port call date was the 29th of March, 1969, which is 5 months later. So I was never targeted to go over North Vietnam. But we had...
Well, I just wanted to know about your three missions, you know. Forward air control missions, we'll talk about that in just a minute.
Right. We had search and rescue missions that the A-1 could do, and this is what Dave alluded to about going to pick up people that had been shot down in bad territory. They were called the Sandy missions because that was a call sign, was Sandy. And it was a good airplane for night missions. We weren't allowed to go over the Ho Chi Minh Trail in the daytime because there were so many guns on the trail, and we were too vulnerable because we were slow. Where Dave flew the F-105, it was fast. The A-1 was slow. We were typically at 140 knots, so when we rolled in, and we did a 40-degree dive angle going after the target. And as far as search and rescue goes, that was not in the curriculum when I went through the Hurlburt field, but that was something that we did at night when we got assigned to missions up in northern Laos, which was not a very not a very productive mission, I thought.
Well, now you go through pilot training, and it's all nose wheel. You don't have any tail wheel. Now you get down to Hurlburt, and all of a sudden you got this big monster here with this tail wheel. Tell us about your transition into that.
Yeah, that was a real transition. Out of pilot training, I got an F-106 assignment, and I flew F-106s for 19 months in the fighter squadron at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware in the 95th. And then I got assigned to the A1. And when I got down to Hurlburt, we got, as Sam said, we got a tailwheel. We got a big reciprocating engine with cowl flaps and mixture, fuel mixture, and all the other things that are involved in an airplane with a reciprocating engine. And so it was a real transition to go to a tailwheel, and the mission was different also. The interceptor was what we did in the F-106, going after incoming invaders, if you will, Soviet bombers, if they were going to come in. That was the defense against those, whereas this mission was air-to-ground, and it was a totally different mission.